Okay, hello everybody, and welcome back to another week of answering your shaylas. As always, all of our learning should be l'zuchus refuah shleimah for Joko, and we thank Joko so much for arranging this this nice program where we get to discuss these fascinating shaylas. And I want to thank everybody for submitting shaylas, submitting questions. I find it a very enjoyable a part of my week where I get to go through the interesting questions that are being submitted. Okay, so here we are. Question number one: what was harder for Rabbi Leibowitz as a communal leader, COVID or the months following October 7th? It's hard for me to think in retrospect about things that are still going on and that are still, obviously COVID's not going on anymore, but it's still, it's still fresh, and certainly October 7th. The war's not over, and there's still a lot of people that are whose lives are changed, many of whom forever. So it's hard to really fully assess, right now. However, I would say a couple of things. First of all, in a certain sense, COVID was harder as an American communal leader, in the sense that after the initial health crisis, it became a crisis of achdus. People were saying terrible things about each other and accusing each other, and there was a lot of sinna and things like that. And that, in a sense, is much worse than fighting our enemies as we are in a post-October 7th world. I think that's the part that Rav Asher Weiss has, where alai hayu kulana, that the promises of curses that the Jewish people are going to suffer were Esav, Lavan, and Yosef. Esav and Lavan were external enemies. Yosef was our internal enemy that we decided to fight against each other, and that's why when Yaakov wanted to steal the Bechorah. I think it's a Vilna Gaon that says this. When Yaakov wanted to steal the Bechorah, and he was nervous that he was going to get cursed for doing this, his mother Rivka told him, "Alai kilalascha b'ni. Your klalos are just ayin lamed yud. It's Esav, Lavan, and Yosef. This is not going to be one of your klalos. This is not going to be one of the things that you're going to have to deal with." And that's why when Binyamin was not sent back. When they were, Binyamin was asked for, rather, and Shimon was not sent back from Mitzrayim, Yaakov said, "I don't understand. Alai hayu kulana." So that's what Vilna Gaon says. I think Rav Asher Weiss quotes in his Haggadah, "Alai hayu kulana. I'm not supposed to suffer another curse. I already suffered Esav, Lavan, and Yosef." And Rav Asher Weiss just points out that of those three curses, Yosef is the hardest one, because it's what we do to ourselves. And there's nothing more heartbreaking than seeing the Jewish people suffer based on our own inability to get along with one another. So that was the more, the one of the greater, more depressing parts of dealing with COVID. Obviously, the health crisis and people dying and having to shut down shuls was extremely heartbreaking, as is dealing with making sure that people understand the enormity of what's happening in Eretz Yisrael and what it's like for a family to be without their father, their son, their and what it's like for people to not come back for months at a time, or not come back at all, or come back entirely changed, and all the post-traumatic stuff. That's hard to measure. In both situations, there is a certain challenge in maintaining an intensity. The second wave of COVID, when people were tired of it already, also killed people in that September, that Yom Noraim season. I know of people that I was pretty friendly with, actually, that died from that second wave, when they just had enough and they just didn't want to deal with it anymore. And obviously in our tefillah, it's like the intensity of our tefillos, we can't let up. We got to make sure that we're davening just as hard. In a certain sense, when there's a time of crisis, that's when leadership really matters. Meaning, at other times, you're just going through the motions and you're doing what you need to do. But that's where people are most keen to their attuned to their need for a sense of guidance. And, Rabbi Berman, our president here in Yeshiva, likes to say that when there's a disruption, it's an opportunity. Even if a disruption is a terrible disruption, like COVID and like this war. But every disruption presents an opportunity. It presents an opportunity for growth. It presents an opportunity to rethink everything and to change the way we go about doing things. So I think communal leaders need to think of it that way as well. Okay, question number two. Is one allowed to go into a non-kosher Dunkin' Donuts and purchase a coffee, flavored coffee, non-flavored coffee, latte, similarly coffee on the airplane, assuming there is not a local kosher store nearby? If allowed, is a bidyeved or okay l'chadchila? So I think when you're talking about a chain store like a Dunkin' Donuts, it's different than going into a local coffee shop. When it's a local coffee shop, so anything with flavors, you need hashgacha. You can't assume that it's kosher. Dunkin' Donuts, if you know that their French vanilla coffee is kosher in all your local kosher Dunkin' Donuts, chances are it's the same French vanilla coffee that they're serving in the tray for Dunkin' Donuts. They don't have two types of French vanilla coffee. They do have two types of bacon. They have the vegetarian fakin that they have at many of the kosher Dunkin' Donuts, and then they have the real bacon. So that would be really, really bad if you made that mistake. But you can't get any food, obviously. There's Bishul Akum problems. There are other issues. You can't get any food at a non-kosher Dunkin' Donuts. But a coffee, traditionally, it's always been assumed that you could buy a plain coffee anywhere. So I would assume that even though it's not like popular within the world of kashrus to say this, and I'll probably get in trouble for saying it, but I would assume that a basic beverage like a coffee or a latte, even French vanilla or hazelnut or something like that, is kosher in any Dunkin' Donuts, as long as you know that that beverage and that flavor is offered at your local kosher Dunkin' Donuts as well. Nevertheless, there is a good thing to do. It's a good hidur, it's a good chumrah, that when you're in a frum community that has kosher options, to avoid these kinds of questions, to avoid these kinds of things. In fact, Rav Yisrael Reisman has said that he has a personal chumrah that he never puts anything without a hashgacha in his mouth, period. No matter, even things that don't require a hashgacha, anything without hashgacha in his mouth, that's a certain level of chumrah. But there's certainly a difference between, let's say, I live in the Five Towns. My brother lives in San Jose, California. So there's certainly a difference in terms of the level of need to rely on things like this. What could go wrong with a coffee or a flavored coffee in a Dunkin' Donuts? The way they do their dishes, it could be that they're cleaning the equipment and the same equipment that they're cleaning the bacon stuff with. I'll just point out also that in the Five Towns Dunkin' Donuts, we do not allow, I don't know if I pointed this out on an earlier answering your shilas, but we do not allow fakin, the vegetarian bacon or sausage in the Five Towns Dunkin' Donuts. And the reason we don't allow it is because it's happened more than once, where a delivery, no fault of the owner or anything like that, a delivery guy just dropped off the wrong box, and he dropped off a box of bacon. Thank God an alert mashgiach caught it, and it didn't make its way into the store even, but that's a little too risky and a little too close for our liking. So I would avoid the fake sausage and fake bacon at any kosher Dunkin' Donuts even. But again, Me'ikra Din, the coffee is probably kosher. Just don't tell anybody I said so. And it's always good to have certain chumras when it comes to kashrus. Okay, question number three. What's Rabbi Leibowitz's opinion on stockings? Is it halacha or is it chumrah? Okay, this is a little bit of a sugya. The Gemara says in Brachos Daf Chaf Dalet that shok bi'isha erva. This is machlokas what the shok is. The Bach in Or Chaim Siman Ayin Hey says that shok means the lower leg, like between the knee and the ankle. So even exposing that would be erva. But the Prima Gadim in Simanayin Hay says that shok means the thigh, the upper leg, from the knee to the waist, the knee and up to the waist. So that's how the Prima Gadim writes. The nafkamina between them is whether a woman has to cover her lower leg. According to the Bach, she has to cover her lower leg. According to the Prima Gadim, she only needs to cover the upper leg. But everyone agrees that if you're in a place where women generally cover a specific part of the body, then all women in that place have to conform to that standard of modesty. So if, let's say, you're in a place where all women wear gloves, so then women would have to wear gloves. That would become minhag hamakom if that minhag is a result of is based on tznius. The Mishnah Berurah seems to pass like the Prima Gadim, that the real shok is the upper part of the leg, not the lower part of the leg. Chaznish doesn't really say otherwise, but there are other poskim that do say otherwise. The Chayei Adam, the Alter Rebbe, and Shulchan Aruch Rav, and Minchas Yitzchak, Shevet Halevi, Rav Eliashiv, meaning there are a lot of people that say that it's the lower part of the leg. Now, you would imagine if the lower part of the leg is erva, that you would need to cover it the same way you cover the top part of the leg. However, one could argue that no, the top part of the leg has to be covered with a skirt in order for it not to be provocative. The lower part of the leg is not so provocative anyway, so maybe as long as you just cover it with something, that's going to be good enough. So that's where stockings comes in. So as a matter of halacha, I think we generally assume that the upper part of the leg is the shok, even though there are many rayas from Shas not that way, but we don't have to get into that right now. That the upper part of the leg is the shok, that's the erva, and the lower part of the leg is tali on minhag hamakom. It depends on the common practice. I once asked Rav Shechter, how do you determine common practice? Is common practice based on the way the average non-Jew walks in the street, the average non-Sanua Jew walks in the street, or the way people who are careful about halacha in general would dress? And he thought it's that last option. It's the way that people who are careful about tznius and about halacha would dress. So if you live in a community where most people who are careful about tznius and halacha are makbit to wear stockings, so then a woman, it would become obligatory that a woman would have to wear stockings. But if you live in a place where people who generally are careful about tznius, the married women cover their hair, and the not married, and all the women, you know, wear dresses with sleeves, and they cover the upper part of the leg and things like that, and you know, necklines and whatever else, and they don't wear stockings, so then it would not be required to wear stockings. So it would be something that's taloi on minhag hamakom. I can't tell you what the minhag of your makom is. You got to look around and see what sanua people do to figure out what the minhag of your makom is. Question number 4: why do women wave their hands by the Shabbos candles during candle lighting? I know there's a halachic source for covering the eyes, but what's the source for the waving? The truth is, I don't think there is one. I mean, here's what it is. The Ramah in Siman Reish Samach Gimel talks about saying the bracha on hadlakas neros over las yasam before lighting the neros. And he says there are two opinions. Some say that you're supposed to say the bracha before you light the neros, and some say that you should dafka say the bracha after you light the neros, because by lighting the neros, you're already being, by saying the bracha, rather, you're already being makabel Shabbos, and therefore, you can't be lighting neros after you're already makabel Shabbos. So the Rama writes, those who say the bracha after lighting the neros, which is the common practice, I think, amongst most Jews, most Ashkenazi Jews, the Rama writes, "Ukedei sheyehei over las yaso," in order that the bracha should be somewhat over las yaso, lo yahana mimena ad la achra bracha. You shouldn't get any hana from it until after the bracha. So this is the source that the questioner is referring to of covering the eyes, so you don't see the ner until after the bracha. But that's not what the Rama says. The Rama doesn't say cover the eyes. Hayad lifnei haner acharad laka umevarchim. The Rama says, put your hands out in front of the candle so that you don't see the candle. Not in front of your eyes, but in front of the candle so you don't see the candle and until after the bracha. And then right away, take your hands out from in front of the candle. So that's probably what it's based on. That is probably the waving the hands in front of the candle is probably a corruption of that original minhag of putting your hands in front of the candle. I should note that Rav Shechter instructed his Rebbetzin when they got married that she should say the bracha over las yasa, that she says the bracha on the candles before lighting the candles. In fact, Rav Schachter himself says the bracha of Al Netilas Yadayim before washing his hands. Right? One of the exceptions of Avodas Yasin that we typically do is we say the bracha of Hashem Kishom Sos Yisrael Al Netilas Yadayim after washing, before we dry our hands. He says the bracha before he even washes his hands. That's what we once had a Talmud, DRS, who had gone on Shabbos to hear Rav Schachter. He was a scholar in residence in one of the local shuls, and he saw that Rav Schachter had said Al Netilas Yadayim before washing at Shalosh Shudas. So he told Rav Schachter, "Oh, I think you made it, Rabbi made a mistake. The halacha is really supposed to say Al Netilas Yadayim after you wash your hands." And he said, "Oh, sorry, I forgot. Thank you for telling me." But he didn't forget. He does that as a shita. He just didn't want to embarrass the Talmud. Okay, question number five. How are we supposed to relate to certain parts of the Torah which seem very foreign to us? So one example which always bothers me is the ability of a father to sell his minor daughter into marriage against her will. So this is an excellent question, and I'm just going to pick on the particular example, because in different examples we'll have different answers. But let's take that as an example. Not in general in Torah, there are three areas. There are things that are mitzvos, there are things that are isurim, and then there are things that have a chalos, that it works, but it's not a mitzvah nor an iser. So it's important to know that just because something works, it does not mean that it is something you're allowed to do. It could be an iser, it could be a mitzvah to do. We don't know. The fact that something is effective does not make it something that does not imply that it is mutter to do. For example, it is usher for a kohen to marry a divorced woman. If a kohen marries a divorced woman, she is an eshes ish. They are married, but he's not allowed to. It's an iser in the Torah. Yeah, it works if you do it. The halacha that a father can sell his minor daughter and give her over for, accept kesef kiddushin for her and sell her as nami ivriya, all those halachos, it works. It doesn't mean that it's a mitzvah to do, nor does it mean that he's even allowed to do it. It could very well be that it is prohibited to do that just because it works. The truth is, in the world of teva, in the world of reality, we have things like this also, that totally unfair to the victim of certain things, but it works. Meaning, let's say you have a woman who's pregnant and she smokes during the pregnancy, or she's smoking crack the whole pregnancy. So the baby comes out sick and brain damaged and whatever. What did the baby do? But she wasn't allowed to do it, but it worked. It had an impact. It did something that impacted somebody else. So in the world of halacha, the same is true, right? A man has a relationship with a woman that he shouldn't have a relationship with, a married woman. The child is a mamzer. What did the child do? It's not about what the child did. It's not about whether it's fair or not, but sometimes something just has an impact. It's just built into reality. So what the Torah is informing us by the sale of a young girl is that the sale is binding. Now, whether that's fair or right, you know, it's not the same as Mamzerus in the sense that whether it's fair or right likely depends on society, meaning whether that is a moral thing to do or an immoral and forbidden thing to do probably depends on the society that you live in. Take, for example, marrying a 15-year-old girl. In certain countries and certain cultures, that was nothing wrong with that. And that was a great mitzvah, and that's what people did all the time. It would probably be immoral in America in 2025 to marry a 15-year-old girl. It's certainly illegal, but probably immoral as well. So one has to be careful when it comes to these things. What the Torah is telling us when we learn these sugyas is not that these are things one is supposed to do, nor necessarily the things that are even permissible to do, but it's just that it works. It's just that it has some type of chalos. So I think that's an important distinction. A lot of times people get confused by. In fact, I find that when people who are otherwise not don't have strong learning backgrounds, and later in life they start to decide to pick up learning, so they pick up Daf Yomi. So by the nature of the learning of Daf Yomi, it's fast-paced, and you have a lot of these kinds of topics that come up. And if you're not a lamdan, it makes it sound like, oh, so all this is normal. So this is a normal thing to do. No, nothing in the Gemara has to be normal. It doesn't have to be a way to behave. It's a halachic system. It's a legal system where you learn what is chal and what is not, and you have theoretical constructs to be able to fit in all of life into. But one has to be very, very careful for someone who's uninitiated and who doesn't understand the methods of Talmudic thinking of the way the Gemara works. So then these things can become very jarring when they're misunderstood. Okay, question number six. Ooh, I better speed this up. If the halacha seems to be that one must conform to the nusach of the minyan one is davening in for things said out loud, why does it always seem that when it comes to saying Kaddish, there are multiple nuschos being said at the same time? So I would bet it's not always. It's when there's a Sfardi there, because Sfardim don't hold that you conform to the nusach. Meaning, Rav Moshe Feinstein says you have to conform to the nusach that's said out loud. Rav Avadya Yosef, if I'm not mistaken, says, no, we're Sfardim, we're right, they're wrong, and therefore we should proudly do what we hold to be right. So Sfardim typically will say a Sfardi Kaddish, and in my experience, Ashkenazim love it. There's nothing that an Ashkenazi loves more than to shout out in the middle of the shul, Revach! So, okay. Question number seven. What does Rabbi Leibowitz suggest is the best way to start preparing for Pesach? So you don't need me. The Gemara says that Sholim V'dorshim B'Hilchos HaChag Sholim Yom Kodem HaChag. So start learning the halachos. That's number one. What book should you use to learn the halachos? So there are many good halacha books. Obviously, classically, you can learn Shulchan Aruch with Mishnah Brura. That's a lot to learn through. I would recommend Rabbi Yehuda Balzam has a wonderful sefer in English on that goes through the sugyos al pi halacha very carefully and very well. So that's an excellent book to read and to learn. So that's number one. Number two, I would always recommend pick a Haggadah. Pick a Haggadah that you want to learn. Pick a commentary on the Haggadah that's going to be your commentary for that year that you go through, and start going through it sooner rather than later. Number three, I would suggest think about how to best enhance your Seder. A Seder needs hachana. You can't just show up and expect that everything is going to be exactly the way you want and it's going to be a dream Seder. So think about who's going to be there, what will appeal to the people that are there, and what will make it a more meaningful experience. Speak to people about that. Speak to your Rebbeim about that. Speak to your family members in advance about that, about how to make it as meaningful a Seder as possible. And just for B'nai Yeshiva, I would say, make sure you have a plan for B'nai Zmanim. Rav Gifter Zichron Levracha used to recommend that people have a kleina mesechta, that they pick a small mesechta to try to cover over B'nai Zmanim. Or pick a perek, that, you know, over B'nai Zmanim, I'm going to learn this perek of the mesechta that I didn't get to, or I'm going to chazer this perek, I'm going to learn every tosos in the perek, whatever it might be. You have to pick a project in a place where you, in a context where you don't have as much structure. Okay, question number eight. Many of us experience significant growth during our year in yeshiva, sometimes reaching levels of seriousness and intensity in Yiddishkeit and even in halacha that weren't part of our homes we grew up in. How should one navigate returning home with this growth when it differs from the approach of his parents? Additionally, how can one respectfully disagree with his parents, both in this context and in general? Excellent question, requires a lot more than the couple of minutes I'm about to give it, but I think the foundation has to be that there's a ton of respect for your parents. Your parents paid for you to be in yeshiva. They sacrificed a lot for you to have a better learning opportunity and more learning opportunities than they did. You know, the Chai Adam writes, the Chachmas Adam writes, that a person is supposed to honor his parents, b'machshava, b'dibor, b'maisa. So I understand how you do it, b'maisa, you help them out. I understand how you do it, b'dibor, you speak reverentially toward them and kindly toward them. What does it mean, b'machshava? So he explains, it means that one is supposed to think of their parents as if they are gedolei olam. That's the way one is supposed to view one's parents. So always the utmost respect. Now, whatever I tell you is not going to guarantee that there won't be growing pains. A lot of times there are growing pains. It is a little jarring for a parent to see that their child went through significant changes in their life. But so it may not always be smooth. But the extent to which you are serious about your commitments, meaning you're actually learning, you're actually working on your midos, you're actually nice to your little sister, you're actually on time to minyan every day. The more you'll be respected for it in the long run. When your parents see that it's something that you're serious about and you're consistent about, again, there may be some growing pains, but in the long run, it will work out much better for you. I would also suggest, don't disagree with your parents unless they ask for your opinion. Just stay silent. Not everything that is said that you don't agree with has to be addressed. And you should know that in the long run, I know of many cases where parents were inspired to increased observance, more Talmud Torah, things like that, by children who are tremendous Balei Midos and who the parents ultimately looked up to the children greatly. Number nine, is it allowed to eat food in the Beis Medrash nowadays? So Shulchan Aruch talks about this in Siman Kuf Nun Aleph, and he quotes that Talmidei Chachamim v'Talmideihem can eat in the shul in the Beis Medrash, but only midochak. So then the Shulchan Aruch then quotes the Ran that in the Beis Medrash you don't even need to be midochak, that in the Beis Medrash you could eat anyway. So the definition of Chachamim v'Talmideihem is pretty much anyone who wants to learn, anyone who's committing themselves to learn. And dochak means something that would otherwise cause bittul Torah. So if you need to eat or drink in a Beis Medrash, you need to sip a coffee to concentrate or something like that. So that l'chora is mutter in a Beis Medrash. In a shul, not okay, but in a Beis Medrash, that would be okay. But one very important caveat to the whole thing: when you sign up to go to a particular yeshiva or a particular Beis Medrash that is owned by somebody else, and they have rules, you have to follow their rules. Even if those rules are not exactly what you're entitled to al pi halacha in a Beis Medrash, that's talking about where it's a random, stam Beis Medrash. But if it's a Beis Medrash that allows you in on the condition that that you follow their rules, then you have to follow their rules. Finally, question number 10. If you're doing Shnayim Mikra with Rashi, and there's no Rashi on the Pasuk, what should you do? So the Mishnah Berurah actually talks about this Beferish, and the Mishnah Berurah says that Pesukim that don't have Rashi, you should just read a third time. I'll just add, though, that the Mishnah Berurah also says that it's a really nice thing to do both Rashi and Unkelus on every Pasuk. And if you do that, then you don't need to read a third time because you're doing Unkelus anyway on the Pasuk, meaning each one has its own benefits. Both Rashi and Unkelus each have their own benefits to them, their own advantages to them. So if you are able to, if you have the time, it's a really nice thing to be able to do. Okay, everyone have a great week, a great Shabbos, and thank you so much for sending in these wonderful questions.
Rose is your name, but when you poop, it sure don't smell like roses. You're number two, burns the hair in my nose. But we fought hand in paw, now your poop don't stink at all. Now that the air is clear, I'll treasure your front and rear, my sweet rose.
Instantly neutralize poop stink with Poop Fighter from World's Best Cat Litter for the world's best cat.